Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 123 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me, as always, is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
And sitting next to you is the Pimping Bell, which is also part of the team. The Pimping Bell exists to highlight especially question-worthy or testable content, little nuggets, so pay attention when the Pimping Bell chimes a pearl. And also joining us today is Dr. Steve Feldman. Welcome back, Woo! Dr. Feldman.
It's a pleasure to be with you again.
Pleasure to have you again. Would you like to introduce yourself if anybody happens to not have listened to any of your other episodes with us?
Yeah, I'm Steve Feldman. I'm a professor of dermatology, pathology, and social sciences and health policy at the Wake Forest University School of Medicine here in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
And you also know a lot about behavioral economics and its applications in medicine. In fact, you've written a book about it. It's called An Illustrated Dictionary of Behavioral Economics for Healthcare Professionals. Friends, you can find it on Amazon, and we've been using it as a bit of a roadmap to talk about various concepts in behavioral economics. And I want to talk about the halo effect today, what is chapter 9 in the book. Steve, what's the halo effect?
Yeah, well, all of these effects are examples of the way people tend to be irrational in predictable ways. And, you know, just how we present things to people can have a big effect on their thinking. It reminds me of every time Michelle says, beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas, which basically means it's almost a desert, you know, with dust storms and stuff, you know. But it sounds much better if you describe it as beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas, especially when you're trying to recruit new faculty.
Which we are.
Yeah.
It's so, a lovely thing.
The halo effect is a really nice example of this phenomenon where there are a lot of things in human decision-making are so complicated and so opaque that we don't have good information to make a decision, but we still have to make a decision. So we find something else to base our decision on. And so I just love the example of how our offices look to people. Mm-hmm. If you present your office well, if it's clean and neat and orderly, and your office staff is friendly and well organized, and you don't keep people waiting long and all of that sort of thing, patients are almost certainly going to think they're going to get great medical care from you. Now, none of that stuff has anything to do with the quality of medical care, but patients are going to think they're going to get great medical care. And in contrast, if the parking at your office is miserable and people can't find a spot and the waiting room floors are dirty and there's gum on the chairs that's hardened in and stuff, and your office staff is surly, and you are the best doctor on the planet in terms of making the right diagnosis and prescribing the right therapy and caring for patients, they may still think, God, I don't trust this guy. This is horrible medical care. I need to go someplace where I'll get better care.
Mm-hmm. That actually, I saw that happen when our VA clinic here got a new building. We had a very vintage building that had, you know, the rainbow curtains of despair, that era of decoration in it. And the patients used to, you know, complain a lot about their care there. And our metrics were good, but they weren't great. We still did, you know, our utmost to give good care to our patients. But our ratings since we moved into the new building, which is brand new and very nice looking, have been 20 points higher. Like, I mean, it's crazy. And, you know, it's a few residents changed, but I guarantee it wasn't that, you know, one class of residents didn't make the difference. It was the building. It makes a big difference.
You know, Michelle, I published a lot of papers, and one reason for that is every chance I get, I see something that seems really interesting. I encourage my minions to try to publish it. What you've just described, I don't know if you were thinking about publishing it, but that's mm-hmm. a really fascinating observation that I think could have an impact on the care patients get if you have time to put that together.
I will try. That is a good idea. That's a good idea.
One reason I like the halo effect is because it dovetails with one of my bizarrely soapboxiest topics, which is that we should dress nicely in clinic. I like to come in nice shoes and a nice tie. I wear a white coat. I'm not saying you have to, but occasionally I have rotators come in, oftentimes from non-dermatologic services, who look like they're on their way to an outdoor concert or something after they're done with clinic. And I just don't think that presents the right look to the patient. So if we look nice, patients will think that we're doing good, even if we're not. So now I can explain it to the residents thusly. I'm really not a very good dermatologist, but I disguise that fact by wearing a tie. You can do the same. Even if you are a good dermatologist, it can't hurt.
I think you're a great dermatologist, but I can attest, even as a resident, Luke is always sharply dressed.
That's
awesome. And
his
patients noticed.
How often do you get that white coat washed? Regularly?
Fairly regularly. The department
it doesn't
pays
have
for it.
The brown stain around the collar. That's how I know it's time for me to switch out to a new one. I think, you know, putting on that white coat, again, if it's nasty looking, it could be a negative. The other thing I do is I keep a stethoscope, a nice big old stethoscope in my white coat pocket. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I never use it for anything other than communicating to patients that I am an attending physician.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I haven't gone that far. I don't like how heavy they are. Maybe I can get one like embroidered into the pocket. So the halo effect can be summarized as every patient's crazy for a well-dressed doctor. It also has impacts on those of us who do cosmetic treatments, right? Because mm-hmm. attractive people are treated better. And then people think that they're smarter, more competent, nicer, happier than they are. So if we can provide that image to people, that it sounds like we improve their lives. And sometimes people who have the option of paying money to get people these treatments, like insurance companies, won't cover them because they're cosmetic. But these quote cosmetic treatments, I think, can move the needle in that sense more than we give it credit for.
Wow, that's such an important point. I think among medical dermatologists, the community that I'm in, I think there's a tendency to disparage cosmetic treatment when really, the cosmetic treatments may be doing more to improve patients' lives than fixing the psoriasis does sometimes.
It would be interesting to see research on that specifically. Like, I don't know how you get rid of all the confounders, but I've also seen research that says attractive people, like, get paid more, for example. So if you make somebody more attractive and they get paid more, then they, like, pay for their Botox.
Yeah, well, I think research has been done. The question's been answered. There's willingness to pay studies. You look at how much people are willing to pay for improvement in their psoriasis versus getting rid of a wrinkle. And sure enough, people are willing to pay a lot more to get rid of a wrinkle than they are to take care of their psoriasis. And there could be other factors involved, whether they think their insurance should be paying for it instead of them. But I think there's good evidence that what I do may not be as important as what the people who do cosmetic work do.
there's been some interesting studies that kind of dovetail into the medical dermatology world as well, looking at acne scarring. There were a couple of very well done studies where they presented participants who were looking at these photographs with identical faces, but with or without acne or acne scarring, and asked them to characterize the person based off their appearance. And the patients who had active acne lesions were more likely to be interpreted as shy, untidy, dishonest, chronically late, that kind of stuff, just by the presence or absence of acne. Acne scarring had even worse findings for men, especially. Men were very significantly more likely to be perceived as untrustworthy if they had acne scarring versus the same man's face, but without the acne scars. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, we judge books by their cover. I was seeing a patient one day. I walked in the room, somebody I hadn't seen before, had been seeing my partner, Alan Fleischer. Al and I are very similar. I have a little more hair, but other than that, you know, we trained together. I think we practice pretty similarly. I was talking to this patient, and maybe I was in the room for a minute, and he said, "I like you better than Fleischer." And I'm like, oh, you're crazy. We're basically the same person. What are you talking? You know, we left the room and the student, who I guess had been listening to me too much, says, I think I understand why he said that. And I'm like, why? He said, well, it's because of that tie you're wearing today. I was wearing my floral spring tie. And like Luke says, I think it communicated to patients what a nice, caring, friendly doctor I was, even if I wasn't, you know, or whether I am or not. Patients can't tell that. They can only tell from the halo of the tie that I'm a caring doctor.
This really makes me want to put out some Dermosphere merch. We can do the Steve Feldman floral tie. We can do the wooden duck that we talked about last episode.
Exactly. You know, best duck ever.
All right. Well, the halo effect, I feel like, is pretty easy to grok anyway, and probably plays a lot more impact in our lives and our patients' lives than we give it credit for. So pay attention, friends, if you think you might be distracted by the halo effect sometimes. Steve, thanks so much for joining us again. Where can our listeners find out more about you or your work if they would like to do so?
Oh, gosh, that's an interesting question. Well, I have, I guess, just doing a PubMed search. Probably be the on Feldman SR, probably pull up all the research we do.
You don't have the social medias?
I guess I am on Facebook and Twitter.
All right, there you go. And also Amazon and probably the Winston-Salem website, I would imagine.
Yeah, Wake Forest, sure.
Wake Forest, thank you. Winston-Salem's a town. I'm in the West. I don't know what's going on over there with you guys. All right, well, we'll see you next time, Dr. Feldman. Thanks very much again for joining us. Michelle, I want to talk about a disease that can be a real pain in the butt.
Tell me more, Luke.
I would be happy to. So this article is out of a journal called Dermatopathology, and it is called Reactive Epidermal Hyperplasia and Angiogenesis of the Rear, parenthesis R-E-A-R, a proposed unifying name for senile gluteal dermatosis and pyrigiform angiomatosis. The authors include Michelle Whiting Liang and Joyce S.S. Lee out of Singapore. So I received a biopsy result not too long ago, and the dermatopathologist suggested that I consider, quote, senile gluteal dermatosis in the differential, and I had never heard of that, and thus I found this article. So it looks like this entity might be what I would call pressure dermatosis or something more banal like that, because it usually shows up as a result of prolonged sitting. It shows up as a rash on the butt in people, usually over the age of 50 or 60. It has also been called pyrigiform angiomatosis. It was called that in 2020. And the authors of this particular article propose the unifying and amusing name of REAR, R-E-A-R, to describe it. And again, R-E-A-R is supposed to stand for Reactive Epidermal Hyperplasia and Angiogenesis of the Rear. I guess the hyperplasia doesn't show up in the acronym, otherwise it would be REHAR. But rear is certainly funnier.
You say it with a British accent, rear. You know, there's an H implied in the thing.
There you go. They also describe four cases of it, and they highlight what they call the sitter's triangle, which is where these lesions are found. So, Michelle and listeners, I want you all to find your own sitter's triangle right now. It's okay. Nobody's looking. So reach around and find your coccygeal apex. So your coccyx is like your tailbone. You want to find the very edge of that. And then your ischial tuberosities are what they used to call your sit bones. So as you sit down, they're like kind of in the meat there. They touch the chair that you're sitting on. They're your sit bones, the bones where you're sitting. So the sitter's triangle extends from that coccyx to each ischial tuberosity and forms kind of like a triangle or a triforce, if you will.
The triforce of courage.
The triforce of rear. So this is where you find the lesions in your patients in the sitter's triangle here. And these lesions are generally somewhat lichenified, somewhat hyperkeratotic, erythematous. They can be nodular. And some of the case reports they have here you look at it and you don't automatically think, oh, this is just from somebody sitting for a long time. You think, huh, maybe that's even like a squame or something. And so that's probably why some of these ended up being biopsied. They are usually asymptomatic, but occasionally patients do find them itchy or uncomfortable, especially if they sit on hard surfaces, like perhaps that couch that you made out of driftwood or whatever when you were 14 years old.
Yep, it was scrap wood.
Presumably, the relative hypoxia from pressure over bony prominences causes the reactive angiomatosis seen on biopsy. This sounds a lot like, you know, what could turn into a pressure ulcer or something, right? Because this is all sounds like sort of similar pathomechanism. Mm-hmm. Other histologic features include lymphoproliferation, lichenification, which includes epidermal hyperplasia and a preserved granular layer. Ding, ding, I guess. It's been a little while since I've heard of talked about dermatopathology. And hyperkeratosis.
You did well.
In this article, the authors found some mast cells as well, and they cite some literature discussing how mast cells can be involved in angiogenesis and potentially contribute to itch in some of these patients. I think we've also discussed that mast cells can be involved in rosacea and stuff like that. So,
and androgenetic alopecia. Yep.
And androgenetic alopecia, huh?
Troublemakers. They're troublemakers, Luke.
Those mast cells. I think overall the most important issue seems to be recognizing this entity. The mainstay of treatment is pressure offloading. A couple other little bits that came out of this article about rear. This senile gluteal dermatosis thing was first reported in 1979. Most of the reports have arisen from Asia. The reported prevalence is 13% in patients over 60 with a mean age of 70. And they say increasing prevalence of rear can be seen with increasing age, decreasing lean body mass, and prolonged sitting, of course. I'm sure I've seen this in my patients. I mean, you know, I often will examine under their underwear if they've got a history of skin cancer, for example, and I see, you know, marks that suggest that they've been sitting for a while, but I didn't call it this. And again, if somebody comes in with something kind of strange, but it's in the sitter's triangle and they have this history of prolonged sitting, then probably you can feel a little bit reassured and potentially could try pressure offloading before you start biopsying them.
I think that that's a great philosophy there. And creating a wound in that area, I would discourage if you don't have to do for multiple reasons, especially in patients who are more extreme in age. Well, we've talked about aging backsides, Luke. Do you want to talk about anti-aging for faces?
I want to talk about anti-aging for backsides.
Well, this could potentially work for that too. So this is a very interesting article. This is out of the, I believe, the JAD. I'm just checking to make sure it looks like. And this is from authors Adam Honeybrook and Eric Bernstein, entitled Oral Isotretinoin and Photoaging. So they wanted to do a review, a systematic review, to look at oral isotretinoin and its use to improve specifically photoaging. They looked through PubMed and Cochrane databases for literature published between 1982 and 2020 and used a defined keyword search to find 23 papers that were then reviewed, and they were able to, out of those 23, select six articles that were relevant to the study. The six studies that were relevant included three randomized controlled clinical trials, one non-randomized clinical trial, and two prospective cohort studies. All studies were conducted between 2000 and 2015. Across these six studies, there were 251 patients recruited with a mean of 42 patients per study. Four studies were in favor of isotretinoin to improve photoaged skin. One study showed no benefit, and one study showed no benefit when compared to topical tretinoin. Many of the studies did have some methodological challenges. We'll review them kind of briefly here. Oral isotretinoin may be useful for treating photoaging, but there is insufficient evidence to support its use at this time. And in comparison to other established anti-photoaging treatments, it's not clear if the potential benefits of oral isotretinoin outweigh the risks. So they did have these six studies that they looked at. We know that topical tretinoin is helpful for photodamaged skin. Oral isotretinoin hasn't been studied as extensively for that particular application. But the topical retinoids are known for their cosmetic benefits. Oral isotretinoin, when it's used to treat patients for photoaging, tends to be used at lower doses. When it's used to treat acne, it's dosed between 0.3 to 2 milligrams per kilogram per day for 3 to 6 months or longer.
Two milligrams per kilogram per day?
That's not a dose that I would use, but those are reported extremes in the literature. I agree with you that that would be a walloping dose of isotretinoin. They'd be like, have you seen that SpongeBob episode where he's in Sandy's like tree dome and he forgets his little like his fishbowl he puts over his head? So he's just like slowly dehydrating and trying to pretend that he's fine inside of Sandy's tree dome. And he's like, fine. He's like that. I feel like if you do 2 milligrams per kilogram to people, that's what they probably would look like. But
Michelle, you don't have any children. How are you watching SpongeBob?
Hey, that was my like post-call therapy when I was an intern at the Cleveland Clinic. Cut me some slack there.
Fair enough.
It's a perfect brain vacation for when your brain is tired. So the low to moderate intermediate doses, 10 to 40 milligrams, 3 to 4 times a week for 2 to 6 months, have been studied to treat photoaging, but it's not been established if there's proven benefit or if the benefits outweigh the risks. So when they looked at these studies, they summarized the different studies that they looked through, and they evaluated them according to this Oxford College of Evidence-Based Medicine kind of study paradigm. So there's different levels of evidence. What would you suppose would be the highest level of evidence, Luke?
A plus.
So a level one would be a systematic review or a meta-analysis of relevant randomized controlled trials. Level two would be randomized controlled trials that are large and well-developed. Level three would be well-controlled trials without randomization or systemic reviews of a complete body of evidence or mixed methods interventional studies. Level four evidence is case control or cohort studies. Level five is systematic review and qualitative studies. And then level six gets into more qualitative, descriptive, or single descriptive studies. And then level seven is expert opinion. So we're talking about probably level two evidence here. We've got these randomized controlled trials that were included, as well as three level three studies. Four of the studies that they looked at out of the six were in favor of isotretinoin to improve the photoaged skin. Of those, one of them was this study in 2000 by Hernandez, Perez, and colleagues, where they noted aesthetic benefits with the addition of 10 to 20 milligrams of isotretinoin 3 times weekly over 2 months in combination with skin rejuvenation cosmetic procedures such as cosmetic peels and neuromodulator injections. They had 120 patients they enrolled that were between 35 to 65 years of age. They were followed for 6 months, and half of them were on isotretinoin, half of them weren't, but they had the same procedures. The authors noted that the ones that were concurrently treated with oral isotretinoin had greater cosmetic benefit compared to those who had the cosmetic procedure without the isotretinoin. Subjectively, the improvements were observed in the amount of wrinkling, thickness, and color of the skin, pore size, skin elasticity, skin tone, and reductions were noted in the number of pigment lesions and mottled hyperpigmentation. The main limitation of the study was that there was not really a control. There sort of wasn't that there was a group that had the same procedures without the isotretinoin. They didn't have a group that they just followed, and there wasn't a group that had isotretinoin without the procedures. And the observations were not blinded. The fact that the observations were not blinded creates some significant problems there, because people, regardless of their surface intention, can be motivated by subconscious forces. And if you know that this is one of the patients that you're giving Accutane to, and you're trying to see if Accutane helps when you're doing these cosmetic procedures, it's possible you would be subconsciously predisposed to perceive greater benefit in that patient. So blinding of the observers would have been helpful, and there wasn't a randomization protocol utilized. Another study they looked at was done in 2008, and that was Khalil and colleagues looked at 50 females aged 40 to 60 with phototypes 1 to 3 skin, who got 20 milligrams of oral isotretinoin 3 times a week for a 3-month period. They lost 20 patients to follow-up, which is a lot of patients to lose to follow-up. Biopsies were performed to compare collagen degeneration and skin tropism. I think this is why they lost those 20 patients, because they're like, you're going to put a hole in my face? What are you talking about? In West Texas, that would sound like this. Oh, darling, you're not cutting into my face. That's what they would say in my practice anyway. So of the 30 patients that completed the study requirements, 20 patients self-reported optimal skin quality improvement. 4 patients reported regular improvement, 6 did not respond. Histological improvements in photoaging were noted in 20 of the 30 patients. So in this study, all of the patients had an isotretinoin dose, and 20 out of 30 of them demonstrated histological improvements. So that's some pretty decent evidence there. Rebello and Fonseca and colleagues did a randomized double-blinded clinical trial in 2009. And that gave some additional evidence in favor of using oral isotretinoin for photodamaged skin. This study had 30 female patients between 40 and 55 years that were divided into 2 groups of 15 patients. In treatment group 1, they got oral isotretinoin 10 milligrams 3 times weekly. And the 15 patients in group two received oral isotretinoin 20 milligrams three times weekly. They had one patient that was excluded from group one after they got dyslipidemia. Self-reported patient questionnaires were administered, and they also had blinded clinician evaluations using the Glogau score, which is a score for aging of skin, as a reference. 5-millimeter punch biopsies from the left preauricular area were also taken before and after the treatment period, and 5 patients in each group demonstrated excellent results. So 34% of the patients had excellent results in both dosing groups. The remaining patients from both groups considered the level of improvement average or good. The clinician-reported ratings considered the results average or good as well. A significant increase in collagen fibers was observed in both the 10-milligram group and the 20-milligram group. And a trend towards decrease in elastin was also observed. Elastin arrangement and architecture was more orderly in the post-treatment groups. And according to the clinical assessments, visual improvements were noted in skin texture, wrinkle depth, and color in both post-treatment groups. So both of those groups got some amount of isotretinoin. Now, the more negative findings, they had the two studies that didn't show good improvement. They had a study in 2010 by Bagatin, where they published a study to create some debate here. They had 32 women between 40 and 55 years of age divided into two groups. Group A got 20 milligrams of isotretinoin three times weekly with a nightly moisturizer and daily sunscreen. Group B had the moisturizer and sunscreen alone without the isotretinoin. There was noted improvement in both groups before and after treatment, which is a good argument for just a solid skincare regimen for everyone. But there was no statistically significant difference between group A and group B, according to self-reported patient data, as well as blinded photographic clinician analysis and microscopic analysis. There was a statistically significant reduction in epidermal P53 expression in the oral isotretinoin group, but otherwise they didn't notice any significant changes. And then the other study that was negative in this review was a study in 2014 where Bagatin and colleagues did a follow-up study comparing the clinical, histologic, and immunohistochemical effects of low-dose isotretinoin versus topical 0.05% retinoic acid to treat photoaging. They had 24 healthy Caucasian adults between the ages of 50 to 75 with advanced photoaging. 12 subjects got isotretinoin 20 milligrams every other day for 6 months. 12 subjects were treated with topical retinoic acid cream 6 months every other night. Of the 11 subjects in each group that completed the study, patient and blinded photographic assessment showed overall skin appearance in both groups with some improvement. Histological analysis revealed a statistically significant increase in epidermal thickness, elastosis reduction, and epidermal P53 reduction in both groups. There was no significant difference between the groups, so the authors concluded that low-dose isotretinoin was not superior to 0.05% retinoic acid for the treatment of advanced photoaging. The quality of life scores were reduced for both treatment groups, which was interesting. And then most recently in 2015, there was a study by Bravo and colleagues that assessed the clinical and histologic changes as well as the duration of clinical effect for oral isotretinoin for photoaging. 20 female patients from 45 to 50 years of age with skin phototypes 2 to 6 were treated with 20 milligrams of oral isotretinoin twice daily, 3 days a week for 12 weeks. The patients in the non-blinded clinician assessments were reported and biopsies were done in the preauricular region as well as pre and post treatment. Patients, as well as researching and assessor physicians, noticed improvement in the skin quality. On histopathologic analysis, 65% of patients had improved thickness and distribution of elastin fibers, and 60% showed increase in collagen density, which was kind of notable as a histologic study. So I thought that that was very interesting. So there are a lot of different treatments for photoaging. A lot of patients will come to you and ask if there's a pill they can take, because I think there's a perception amongst patients that that's the easiest way to get a treatment. I know that a lot of patients will ask for a pill they can take for atopic dermatitis. There are those now. There haven't been for a very long time, but there are those now. The closest you could get for a long time was an ill-advised course of systemic steroids. We try to avoid that in atopic dermatitis patients if we can. Occasionally, you have to do it in an emergency situation. But there's a lot of topical therapies that we use for photoaging: retinoids, alpha hydroxy acids, vitamin C derivatives, vitamin E derivatives. There are non-surgical options to help patients with photoaging, like chemical peels and dermabrasion, microneedling, radiofrequency, ablative and non-ablative lasers. Oral isotretinoin is not widely accepted as a treatment for photoaging, but there is some evidence that it might be beneficial. It is, of course, as we know, used to treat acne, and we have to watch certain things such as liver function tests and lipid profiles. Even when we're using lower doses, we still probably need to follow these things, and we have to be aware that it is a teratogen. So any patient being treated with isotretinoin must not get pregnant or donate blood. The timing of the oral isotretinoin may be relevant. As we discussed in the menopause mini-series, changes in collagen distribution can happen relatively precipitously in the like perimenopausal group. And some of these studies were conducted on those patients. So it might be beneficial to do slightly longer lasting studies in different age groups to see if there might be an optimal timing for this intervention. It would be off-label use, of course, to use isotretinoin for photoaging. And so that's a discussion you'd need to have with your patients as well. The oral isotretinoin is also used off-label as a complementary therapy for patients who are getting rhinoplasty if they have thick acne-prone skin to help control the production of sebaceous glands in the skin and subcutaneous tissue. The post-operative nasal tip definition was noted to be improved with perioperative isotretinoin use in rhinoplasty patients, which I thought was very interesting. The other interesting things to think about with oral isotretinoin, of course, is its mechanism of action. We don't really completely understand it. We know it is 13-cis retinoic acid. It's a vitamin A derivative, and it's naturally present in blood and human tissue. It's metabolized in the liver with the cytochrome P450 system, and it's converted upon intake to 5 active metabolites. Isotretinoin reduces comedogenesis by reducing hyperkeratinization, and it also potentially inhibits metalloproteinases of the extracellular matrix that may lead to an increase of types 1 and 3 collagen, which could improve photoaged skin. But there does definitely need to be further study for this. So I think it is a potential future horizon for photoaging, but potentially not quite ready for prime time. And then the management of the medication would have to be considered, how you would kind of take care of the laboratory work and ensure that patients were properly monitored. You are also taking on the risk of potentially being blamed for mood disorders. I think a lot of our recent literature has demonstrated that there's pretty significant safety around the space of mood disorders and isotretinoin, but it's always something to take seriously. What do you think, Luke?
This is an interesting one. I think that we all see how good people's skin looks when they're on isotretinoin.
They get that glow. You know what I'm talking about.
And it's a pretty safe medicine, and we understand it really well. And I think we also have a few patients who have genetic diseases that sort of require them to be on a systemic retinoid all the time, and sometimes they just have, like, the best-looking skin out of any of our patients. So I believe that it does improves the appearance of the skin, and it probably helps specifically with photoaging. I think that the argument that it's better than a topical retinoid is harder to make, especially with that study mentioned here. So I'm not sure. It would be kind of nice to see if those two compared directly. I put Tazarotene 0.1% on my face every night, and I still have this feeling that my skin would look better if I was on isotretinoin. I don't know about this dose in particular, but the dosings that they used were very small, like 1/6 of what one of our acne patients gets probably.
Yeah, pretty gentle.
So, but, and then again, like, is this just a ridiculous discussion? Because cosmetic use of a systemic agent like this, I mean, come on, give me a break. On the other hand, we've also discussed articles that talk about how important it is to, like, be good looking, and we've talked about that people who are more attractive, I believe we talked about it with Dr. Feldman, get higher salaries and stuff like that. So there's something here. I don't know. I think if I had a patient who asked for it, I would entertain the idea at least.
It would create some management challenges because they'd be on it for such a long time. And you would have to enroll them in iPledge to be able to get the medication. And then, of course, you would also have to kind of balance the how you would code it, how you would describe it, if the patient would cash pay for the medication, or if they would try to use insurance, if you would, you know, try to get it covered for a covered indication, or how you would manage that. But it's a very interesting concept.
Well, let's move on to something completely different. I really don't like talking about articles like this next one because it's about child abuse. But it's important for us to know this stuff. And in this case, it's an article that discusses how high should our level of suspicion be when it comes to anogenital warts in kids. And I think this was a CertLink article. It's published in Pediatric Dermatology. The title is Anogenital Warts in Relationship to Child Sexual Abuse, Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. This is from UC Davis. Authors include Smita Awasti, Daniel Eisen, and April Armstrong, who I'm pretty sure if there was an award would win the award for most dermosphered author.
We definitely stan April Armstrong at this podcast.
We do indeed. So this study is a systematic review slash meta-analysis that included, well, 25 studies, mostly in North America and Europe, that involved 791 subjects in what they called a summary synthesis. Only 10 studies had enough data to be included in a statistical analysis, with a total of about 200 subjects. And the upshot is that warts on the genitals, penis and vulva, were a lot more associated with childhood sexual abuse than those in the anal area. So the odds ratio was about 6. So that suggests that if you have a patient who has warts just on the genitals and not in the perianal area, then the odds of that person having been abused are 6 times higher than a patient with warts just in the anal area. Age was also a significant factor. So again, this odds ratio thing. So the odds ratio for abuse in people, kids, age 3 to 4 was about 7.5. For age 5 to 8, the odds ratio was 6.5. And for age 9 to 12, it was 7. And this was all compared to 0 to 2-year-olds, who apparently are really unlikely to be abused. Small favors, perhaps. So basically, the risk for childhood sexual abuse in a 3 to 4-year-old presenting with these anogenital warts was 7 times higher. He had a 7 times higher risk of being abused than somebody who was 0 to 2 with the same presentation. The authors point out that HPV typing was not helpful, so don't bother. The percentage of those abused ranged from 9% in the 0 to 2-year range to 50%. 50%! Gosh. In 9 to 12-year-olds. I like to think that these are overestimates due to a referral bias in some of the included studies, because some of them were studies in sort of sexual abuse specialty departments. They also note that, quote, most of the studies were not of high quality and had major deficiencies. For example, no control groups, small patient numbers. Most studies only reported a few nonspecific variables. Anyway, it looks like we should be extra concerned about childhood sexual abuse in patients who have warts only on the genitals and those who are over age 2. The perpetrators, as we might guess, are usually men known to the family. Come on, other men. Why do you have to give men a bad name? In episode 89, we discussed another article about the cutaneous signs of child abuse. And that article says that our main role as clinical dermatologists is to have suspicion and get the patients to the emergency room where experts can determine if the abuse actually happened. And if so, what to do about it. So they make a pretty good argument that if you think there's a, you know, even not a decent chance, if you think there's a chance that this child was abused, then they have to go to the emergency room and you might have to call an ambulance and have, I don't know, security restrain their parents or something if they're not being amenable, because so many kids apparently like get repeatedly abused and they interface with the healthcare system numerous times before it's actually caught. And, you know, who knows how many times it's just not caught. So, don't like this stuff, but it's certainly a part of our job, and we can play a really important role in somebody's life if we manage to catch it and make it stop. A few other bits that came out of this article: the incubation period of the HPV virus is unclear. Studies suggest anywhere from months to years, and latent and subclinical infections are also common. There is some good news. Overall, childhood sexual abuse rates in the United States have declined since the 1990s. Also, since the HPV vaccine, Gardasil, was introduced, the prevalence of vaccine-type HPV has declined significantly. So there's some good news out there, but there you go. Be on the lookout. It's part of our role as healthcare providers is to keep the children in our society safe.
That is a tough topic to talk about, but a very important one to be educated about. Just as you said earlier, we're going to now talk about something completely different, a palate cleanser, if you will, Luke. What is more fun than talking about child abuse? Almost anything, including being poked with electrified needles. So we're going to talk about electroacupuncture for relieving itching in atopic eczema, a study protocol for a multi-center randomized sham-controlled trial. Now, this
last episode, we talked about probiotics for atopic dermatitis, and here we're doing electroacupuncture for atopic dermatitis. So never let it be said that we don't explore these alternative medicine issues.
You know, our patients are interested in them. Some of our colleagues are interested in them. And there is some reason why some of them might work. So I do like to look into the opportunities that we have. Now, this is an interesting paper because this is actually the study protocol that they're publishing. And the study has not been completed yet, but they do go over the science as to why they think it might be beneficial. This study is out of France and Germany, and the chief authors are Sihan Wang and Xin Li. And there's also, it was France, Germany. I'm trying to see
I think they're mostly out of China. Yeah. I think the journal editors are out of France.
I'm so sorry. I read that wrong. I thought interesting names for people from France and Germany. So that makes a whole lot more sense why some of this stuff seems to be accepted as a given, like the different names for the points of acupuncture. I was like, this seems very, very specific. But this is an interesting and kind of innovative trial design. When you're trying to study something like acupuncture, doing a placebo arm becomes more challenging. But they have a very kind of ingenious way that they have devised to be able to give a sham treatment that would allow for the patient's perceptions to be uninfluenced by the clinical encounter, so that all the patients will have the perception that they're receiving the same treatment. And so atopic eczema, as we know, has risen in prevalence up to 5% of the population in different countries. Some people say even higher than that. Pruritus is one of the most burdensome symptoms of this condition, and it can be underestimated. It can cause a vicious loop of scratching, itching, lichenification, and worsening of the condition. And acupuncture with or without electrical stimulation is one of the more commonly used therapeutic measures to treat atopic eczema in China. This study was designed to objectively evaluate the efficacy and safety of electroacupuncture as an antipruritic technique, and to develop and obtain high-level clinical evidence for the popularization and application of electroacupuncture for atopic eczema. So this is designed to be a multi-center, single-blinded, randomized controlled trial. And the study protocol will require for the patients to be assigned randomly to three equal-sized groups. They will either have electroacupuncture, sham electroacupuncture, which will be real acupuncture because they're still using acupuncture points, and sham acupuncture. The treatment would be administered 3 times a week during a 2-week intervention phase, and they'll follow outcomes on the visual analog scale along with the eczema area severity index and the dermatology quality of life index. As we know, atopic eczema needs more ability to be controlled. There are new therapeutics that have been developed that are more efficacious than what we've had in the past, but there are definitely still treatment gaps. The AAD, as well as the European guidelines for chronic pruritus, don't recommend H1 antihistamines to manage atopic eczema, as we discussed in the previous episode. However, they are commonly used in the clinic because they help mostly, I think, by sedation, to be completely honest. They do have some improvement of itch in some patients. The second generation H1 antihistamines have fewer sedating side effects, but some of them can still cause sedation and can also have cardiotoxic events. Acupuncture has gained importance in dermatology as complementary and alternative medicine therapy and can be used with or without electrical stimulation. It can reduce lesion counts, ease itching, and improve patient quality of life. They've done some animal studies on this particular topic. Acupuncture is more effective than other histamine-independent pruritogens like chloroquine or histamine-dependent pruritogens compounded, and the powerful inhibitory effects of acupuncture on serotonergic itch may be caused at least in part by inhibiting the 5-HT2 and 5-HT7 receptors. Electroacupuncture does some really interesting things. It's been shown to alleviate itch and flare in healthy human adults after intradermal histamine injection. And animal studies have shown that electroacupuncture actually relieves pruritus, which may be due to its ability to cause dynorphin release. Dynorphin was discovered in 1975. It is a neuropeptide that's involved in pain, addiction, and mood regulation, and it binds to the kappa opioid receptor, which is a G-coupled protein receptor. Now, if you remember way back in April of 2023, in episode 105, when we talked about difelikefalin, which sounds like a trap name or something like a trap artist. This is another agonist of the kappa opioid receptor that's used to treat renal pruritus. So this dynorphin release may potentially be material to the amelioration of itch in patients with the therapeutic use of electroacupuncture.
I don't know that much about acupuncture. I'm surprised a little bit that there's an animal model that they can use acupuncture on, because I thought the acupuncture points were specific to human bodies, but perhaps there are analogous spots in a mouse or something.
They're specific usually to tendon attachment points or like spaces between joints. They actually describe some of them very well here. The interesting thing to me is how they will blind the patients. So this has been described, I think, partially to illustrate how they'll conduct the trial, but I think also partially in an instructive way for other people to be able to study acupuncture and electroacupuncture. Acupuncture is going to, you know, require the physician administering the treatment to know what they're doing, because they either have to be choosing correct acupuncture points and real needles or fake needles and fake points to ensure the treatment that is supposed to be given to the patient is given. So the hospital will have several operating researchers who are trained to perform electroacupuncture, as well as obtain the historical and clinical information. They use something called a Park Sham device as a placebo control. The Park Sham device is like a little channel that the needle goes into that is affixed to the skin. And it sort of recapitulates the appearance of the electroacupuncture without actually doing the electroacupuncture. And they'll, of course, allow for significant investigator laterality if somebody's not tolerating the treatment well. They also have a sham needle device that they use that has an outer cylinder that sort of compresses as you push the device toward the skin. And this is what they use on television all the time when they're giving like an injection on television. They use these sham needle devices where there's two sort of telescoping cylinders of metal. And when you press down against the skin in a very imperceptible way, an outer located tube of the metal kind of pushes down and covers over the smaller, more inferior tube to kind of give the impression that a needle's being pushed into the skin, even though the skin isn't being broken. Now, you might be asking yourself, well, can't you tell if you're being poked with a needle or not? Acupuncture needles actually don't really always hurt that much. Have you ever had acupuncture, Luke?
Yeah, but it was a long time ago, probably 25 or 30 years ago.
I have too. I had a medical school class on complementary and alternative medicine, and I actually didn't find it uncomfortable at all. So this double-tubed system for the sham needle I thought was pretty ingenious and basically allows for the perception of acupuncture, even though the patient is not getting acupuncture. And so then for the intervention, though, all three groups would have the Park Sham device attached, which will kind of conceal which treatment that they are getting. But the patients on the electroacupuncture group and the patients on the sham electroacupuncture group has the needles placed on real acupuncture points. The sham acupuncture group will have the needles placed on non-acupuncture points, and they're actually defined sham acupuncture points for these studies. And they're very specific. I'm not going to read all of them, but I'll kind of show you.
So the placebo group doesn't get like acupressure instead. There's something about these specific spots that's supposed to improve atopic dermatitis. And so if you're poking some other spot, the idea is that it's more of a true placebo than poking the same spot, but not with a true needle.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So like some of these are located, for example, there's something called the Hegu point, and that's located between the first and second metacarpals at the midpoint of the radial aspect of the second metacarpal. Like that's the level of granularity that we're talking about here. And then there are sham acupuncture points that will be used. And then all of the patients will have a standard good skincare regimen that will, I think, give the patients some control as well. So this is a fascinating study protocol. I'm interested to see when they publish their findings, what the results will show. But the fact that there might actually be some modulation of the opioid axis, which we know is one of the factors implicated in the sensation of itch, makes it possible that this might do something. So I'm excited to see what comes out of this.
I don't know that I've ever seen like a research protocol published in a journal before, but it sounds like this was there to sort of educate people about kind of how electroacupuncture might work for atopic dermatitis.
Mm-hmm. And how to conduct a study, a randomized controlled study, where the patients can't tell which intervention they're getting so that you have the ability to at least single blind to the study. But it's fascinating. I'm interested to see what comes out of it.
Probably how many electroacupuncture sessions would it be equivalent in cost to a single syringe of dupilumab?
I don't know. That's a very good question. They are going to do three times a week.
5 to 10. Okay, moving on. So in episode 119, we discussed selenium sulfide. For some reason, it seemed to be effective for hyperkeratosis, at least in that study. And then one of our listeners reached out to us. And I might be mispronouncing your name, I'm sorry. Fariba Siraj. Thanks for getting in touch. She asked if we had ever used a product called Magic Shave, which contains calcium thioglycolate. It's an over-the-counter depilatory for hyperkeratosis, which I haven't. And this apparently is a pearl from Dr. Matthew Zirwas. I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name right either, but he's a preeminent dermatologist in Columbus, Ohio. He also got his MD from the University of Pittsburgh. Go Panthers. Have you ever met Dr. Zirwas?
I have met him, I think, at a meeting once. He was lovely. And he's done a lot of very important research on the topic of itch specifically.
And he's involved in clinical trials. We discussed the clinical trial that got roflumilast approved for sebderm in the last episode, and he was the first author on that one. Mm-hmm. Well, Fariba was kind enough to connect us with Dr. Zirwas, who told us about calcium thioglycolate, this Magic Shave product. He said, I absolutely still use it, by far the most effective treatment. And he provided us with a couple of references, which I want to talk about today. The references do not specifically use calcium thioglycolate as a treatment for hyperkeratosis, but this is where the idea came from, and he states that it is super effective. Super was all in caps, guys, so this is serious. One of the references is from the JID from 2008, and the other is, wait for it, from 1971. Thereby definitely winning our award for like oldest article we have ever discussed. And both of them discuss in vitro studies of thioglycolates on human skin, especially stratum corneum. So to do the article's justice, the article out of the JID in 2008 is called The Effects of Depilatory Agents as Penetration Enhancers on Human Stratum Corneum Structures. Authors include Jin Ning Li and Song Jan Lin out of Taiwan. And the article from 1971 was published in the British Journal of Dermatology. It was called Callus and Its Keratin Before and After Treatment with Acid Sodium Thioglycolate. The authors include C.E. Orfenos and H. Ruska out of West Germany.
Ah.
Not Germany, but West Germany. Yes, we're back in history, friends.
Because it was in 71 before the Wall Kingdom. Oh, my goodness.
The short story is that both of these studies show that various thioglycolates cause disruption of the stratum corneum, including both corneocytes and the lipid mortar that holds them together. And because the corneocytes and the lipids are disrupted, among other things, this allows the corneocytes to be shed more easily. The article from the JID highlights thioglycolates as penetration enhancers for drugs, while the article from 1971 discusses the effect of thioglycolates on human callus. They carved two calluses off of the hands of two men and then subjected these bits of callus to thioglycolate immersion and evaluated them under electron microscopy. Thioglycolates are the main ingredients in over-the-counter depilatories. Products like Nair, which contain potassium thioglycolate, and Magic Shave, which contains calcium thioglycolate and seems to be the favored by Dr. Zirwas. And a depilatory means they make your hair go away. So instead of shaving, if you want to like smear one of these things on your legs, that's the idea. They can get rid of the hair that way. and they work as depilatories by breaking the disulfide bonds that hold hair keratin together. And of course, a thick hyperkeratotic foot or heel is got keratin just like hair, so that's the idea. And then these articles provide the rationale and scientific proof that they disrupt this horny layer and cause the keratinocytes to shed. So Dr. Zerwas, in addition, was kind enough to provide us with his protocol for how he has patients use these products, which is as follows. First, get the area damp. Then apply the thioglycolate cream. He says about the same thickness as you'd apply butter to bread. He practices in Columbus, so I'm not sure how thick people put butter on bread in Columbus, but I assume it's rather similar across the country, but I think there's probably some parts of the country where it's like way thicker.
If you apply it like you do in Texas, you can't see through it. So
that's right. So Columbus butter thickness. Then leave it on for about a minute. And then remove it by rubbing firmly with a damp washcloth. Make sure you remove all of the cream. This will also remove the top layer of the skin that the cream has softened. It sounds like he usually prescribes his patients clobetasol as well. So he says, after do this, apply clobetasol cream. And then just do that once a day until the skin feels like normal thickness. And once the skin is of normal thickness, you just need to do it maybe once or twice a week for maintenance. And then if there's itching, but the skin is still normal in thickness, you're welcome to use the clobetasol. So thanks, Dr. Zerwas, for providing us with your protocol. This is pretty cool stuff. I like having more approaches for hyperkeratosis because sometimes those can be pretty difficult to treat. I was kind of excited about the selenium sulfide thing, and this is another fun little tool to try. It would be interesting to see clinical data about the effectiveness, but again, a great pearl. The article from the JID does point out that these products can be used to enhance the penetration of drugs, which potentially has clinical application. But it's also worth warning our patients about if we recommend that they use these for hair removal, because anything they put on their leg or whatever afterward is more likely to be penetrating into their skin for good or ill.
Fascinating.
Well, that's probably all for today. So thanks for hanging out with us today, friends. And thanks for learning about the Halo Effect with Dr. Steve Feldman, this entity called Rear, which is from prolonged sitting. We learned about isotretinoin for photoaging. We learned about condyloma and childhood sexual abuse. We learned about electroacupuncture for atopic dermatitis. And we learned about over-the-counter depilatories for hyperkeratosis. Thanks for hanging out with us. Thanks to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks, as always, to all of the members of Team Dermasphere. We've got a dedicated group of medical students who keep us moving along behind the scenes. Much thanks to Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Laura Dela Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, and Lior Lavin. Among other things, they keep our social media accounts moving. You can find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook. They also create some video content for us. You can find us on YouTube and ViewMedi. Links will be in the show notes. Also, if you are feeling a bit generous and looking for places to donate some money, you can donate to us. We could use some money. You can do so at uofuhealth.org/dermasphere. And if you are looking for ways to hang out with Michelle and I, there are plenty of ways to do it these days. You could join the University of Utah Dermatology Echo Sessions. Those happen every month. You could even present a case if you wanted. Get some CME. It's free. Probably by the time this airs, my prurigo nodularis CME event will be closed, but you can always check the link in the show notes and see if perhaps there's room for one or two more. And then, Michelle, I'm going to rely on you to talk about this Resident Jeopardy that we're doing.
So we will be co-hosting a Resident Jeopardy session at the AAD. Resident Jeopardy is a lot of fun. I've done it for several years, and the resident teams sign up and compete to see who has the best Jeopardy knowledge in dermatology. And it's just like the game show. They buzz in, they answer in the form of a question, and it's quite a lively and fun session. So if you guys want to be either entertained or edified or both, you can definitely come and check it out.
That is all for today, friends. We will see you in 2 weeks.